Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
The trees, you limb them up, you space them out a little bit, so if the fire comes through, it won't destroy the homes and all of that.
Wildland firefighting efforts ramp up as Alaska approaches 2.4 million acres burned this summer. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, July 5th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, how the state saw some of its driest June weather on record.
There's a large fraction of the state from the central interior through south central and through southwest classified as being in a drought.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
Wildfire activity continues to escalate in Alaska. The state logged another 20-plus new fires yesterday, raising the number of active fires to 214 as thousands of lightning strikes were again detected across a wide area from south central to the interior and northern Alaska. KUAC's Dan Bross has more on some of the fires being worked in the interior.
Among the new lightning-caused starts Monday were two fires in the Delta Junction area. State Forestry Fire Information Officer Sam Harrell says the Gold Hub Fire and the Giles Creek Fire are in full suppression zones in the vicinity of the Pogo Gold Mine north of Delta, and both blazes were hit with retardant and water drops.
A lot of this aerial effort is just to slow them down and check them up until we can get crews in there to do some work.
Harrell says the Gold Hub Fire is located along Shaw Creek Road, which accesses the Pogo Mine.
It's going to have an impact on mine traffic that utilizes the Shaw Creek Road.
The Gold Hub Fire was estimated at 1,000 acres last night.
It is rapidly spreading. It's fuel driven. A lot of black spruce up there, and it's working its way through the black spruce pretty good.
The new blazes are additional to others in the area being managed as the Middle Tananaw Complex. With so many wildfires burning across the state, Harrell says many in remote areas are only being monitored.
And then give them attention when they start to move on to, you know, values at risk, whether it's timber, native allotments, cabins out in the woods. So it's a lot of monitoring and making decisions about where our resources are going to best be served.
While some new fires are drawing initial attack, longer-term responses continue on about a dozen others. The largest operation is on the over 50,000-acre Clear Fire west of Anderson, where fire behavior analyst Forrest Ownby says burn activity has increased the last couple of days.
Anytime that the sky clears or the smoke leaves and the clouds leave or dissipate, our fire behavior increases, meaning that we have trees that start to torch, the fire starts to spread faster.
Ownby says one of the more active parts of the fire is west of the Kobe Ag Road turnoff and Clear Space Force Station.
Then as you keep going south along the Teklinik River, the fire has a big head going south there where a lot of activity has continued to move towards the Alaska Range going south there. But staying lower on the foothills, it hasn't really started climbing.
Ownby says protective measures include cutting lines with bulldozers and preparing properties in case flames get past them.
Like in the city of Anderson, they're going around a lot of the structures and trying to remove some of the fuel. So the trees, you limb them up, you space them out a little bit. So if the fire comes through, it won't destroy the homes and all of that.
A Tuesday morning update said the Clear Fire was about 6 miles from the city of Anderson. Ownby says activity is expected to moderate over the next couple of days as higher humidity and slightly cooler temperatures are forecast. Evacuation notices remain in effect for some areas surrounding the Clear Fire, but Denali Borough Mayor Clay Walker says it's unclear how many people have left.
There are some in the GO area that we know who are actively preparing their properties and creating more defensibility. And there are others who've left, and we're not tracking, you know, individuals. It's kind of an area where there's folks who live there year round and folks who have cabins there and come and go.
Mayor Walker emphasizes that no one is being forced to evacuate, but says those in the GO area who remain are doing so at their own risk. He says there's been little use of the Nenana and Tri-Valley schools as evacuation sites.
A lot of Alaskans have other options, from, you know, pulling their camper out and going camping for a while, or staying with friends, or we know some folks have gone up to Fairbanks. You know, I think people are employing, you know, other options other than staying at a school. Because, yeah, we did just have one person spend one night at Tri-Valley School.
Walker says the clear fire does not seem to be impacting tourism, as smoke has been intermittent to the south at Denali National Park, and visitor numbers are up. He thanks the firefighters working the clear fire, noting that despite its growth, no structures have been lost. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
And of course, wildland firefighters have not been helped by the generally warm, dry weather across Alaska heading into July. Parts of South Central, like Anchorage, saw the second warmest June on record, and the month was also expected to go down as the driest ever statewide, if not one of the driest. That's according to National Weather Service climate researcher Brian Brettschneider, back for our Ask a Climatologist segment. And he says, while the meager June precipitation totals aren't official yet, a drought designation for parts of the state is.
There's a large fraction of the state, from the central interior through south central and through southwest, classified as being in a drought. There's up to 5 levels of drought. So, you know, a sizable area is in level 1 drought, what we call D1 drought. And then areas here in south central, focused right around Anchorage, from say maybe Talkeetna down to Kenai and Inilchik, is in level 2 drought, which encompasses now, you know, probably more than half of the population of Alaska. That's probably going to be expanding when we update that next week. So don't be surprised if that level 2 drought area looks quite a bit bigger next week.
That has prompted me to take a drink of this glass of water.
It's so dry.
It's a dry drought.
It's a dry drought. It feels very dry. Speaking of how the conditions feel to us, I saw you quoted in a story about how it might feel hotter in northern latitudes at the same temperature than maybe somewhere farther to the south. How is that possible? What do you mean by that?
Well, there's a couple of ways to think about it. And one is, you know, if you're outside in, you know, Oklahoma, and it's 75 degrees, and the sun is almost straight overhead, the sun really isn't hitting a lot of your body. And even much of this, you know, the sides of your body that it is hitting is a very, very acute angle. And so it really kind of reflects off. And so it's a relatively small fraction of your body that's getting that direct sunlight. Whereas here, our sun angle is much lower. And so when it's 75 degrees in June or July, that direct sunlight is hitting, you know, almost at a right angle, most of your body. And so you're actually accumulating a lot more solar energy at that same temperature here in Alaska than you would be at a southerly latitude.
Interesting. So it's kind of like the wind chill version of the heat in the summertime.
Sure, you can think about it like that.
Yeah. I feel like people down in the lower 48 that have, they're not wearing a hat and maybe they have a bald spot, they're at a greater risk, right, if the sun's just straight down.
Yeah, you know, that's why we have hats. You know, wear the hats out if it's hot and sunny.
Okay. So the natural transition here to fire danger is firemen wear special hats. I don't know, but we need to talk about that for sure. We're at kind of the middle of summer here ish. The heat and the dryness just continue. So where are we at with that? How dangerous are things for fires?
Well, statewide, we are just about at 2 million acres burned. And through the end of June, that's a record. That's the most we've ever had burned through this point of the year. Now, the final season records are in the 5 to 6 million acre range. And so hopefully we don't approach those values. But it has been very, very dry. And there are many, you know, record fires in the southwestern part of the state. In fact, just yesterday, we had more acres burn in Alaska than all of 2021, the entire year. So we're really piling up the fire acreage statistics. And it's really quite dramatic what's going on. And most people have noticed the smoke. Here in Anchorage, we have a slight reprieve from the smoke. But other areas, it's, you know, apocalyptic. Nome had perhaps their smokiest conditions in at least 40 years. You know, close your doors and seal your windows kind of level. And we're really moving toward an upper echelon fire year in Alaska. There's no silver lining to it.
That was National Weather Service climate researcher Brian Brettschneider. Well, records fell at the annual Mount Marathon race in Seward yesterday. In the women's race, rookie Allie McLaughlin from Colorado separated from the field early and held on to smash the women's record by about 40 seconds. At the top of the climb, the 31-year-old was nearly 2 minutes faster than the record. She slowed slightly on the downhill, but no runners were in sight as she approached the finish line in downtown Seward. She told the official race broadcast she enjoyed the home stretch.
I kind of wish I like smiled it more, but I was like, it's gonna hurt as soon as I smile, so I just gotta stay focused.
Seward's Hannah LaFleur finished in second, more than 5 minutes behind McLaughlin. McLaughlin is an accomplished trail and mountain runner who recently won the prestigious Broken Arrow Vertical Kilometer Climb in California. She said she's dreamed of racing Mount Marathon for years, but her plans were sidelined during the COVID-19 pandemic. The previous race record was set by Emily Forsberg of Sweden in 2015. McLaughlin beat her time by 39 seconds. In the men's race, the all-time record was never threatened, but winner Max King of Oregon shattered the best time for racers in their 40s. It was 42-year-old King's second win in his 3 years running the race. He led by about 20 seconds at the top of the mountain and built his lead on the descent. He told official race commentators that the drier than usual conditions on the Kenai Peninsula this year made for a harder trail on the descent.
I started to lose my ankle mobility like halfway down, and I'm like, just stay up. But it's drier than I have ever seen it. It was really dusty, so I was glad I was in the front.
King's win made him the oldest winner in the history of the men's race. He was followed by race rookie Thomas O'Hara, a cross-country skier from Anchorage. The winners of the junior races were Kobe Marvin from Palmer and Rose Conway of Anchorage. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an effort to engage on elections.
All of our stories are complicated. Our views are complicated. There's so much gray. But oftentimes we never talk about those grays.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil exploration and production and working to create economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, celebrating 100 years of helping Alaskans shape a brighter tomorrow. Learn more at fnbalaska.com.
Bill Allen, who was at the pinnacle of wealth and power in Alaska until he was exposed as a central figure in a political corruption scandal, has died. He was 85. Allen founded Vico, which was for years the state's largest oilfield services company. He signed lucrative contracts to clean up Alaska's worst ecological disaster, the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil spill. Journalist Rich Maurer, who covered Allen's legal proceedings for the Anchorage Daily News, says Allen was a force in Alaska politics long before the corruption case came to light.
He was one of the most powerful people in Alaska because he had the money to give to campaigns.
In 2007, Allen pleaded guilty to bribing state lawmakers to win votes for a state oil tax law favorable to his company. The FBI secretly videotaped him in his Juneau hotel suite discussing payoffs to legislators. Allen was also the key witness in the prosecution of U.S. Senator Ted Stevens, whose 2008 conviction was later overturned based on prosecutorial misconduct. Allen was given leniency in exchange for his cooperation and was sentenced to 3 years in prison. He served less than 2 years. A funeral home in Grand Junction, Colorado, announced Allen died on Wednesday. The executive director of the Alaska Democratic Party is charged with driving under the influence and refusing a chemical test after a weekend traffic stop near Soldotna. Alaska state troopers said in a statement that Lindsay Kavanaugh of Anchorage was stopped early Saturday and found to be impaired by alcoholic beverages. Troopers say Kavanaugh refused a breath test, and while at a trooper's post, the statement says she unplugged trooper's equipment. Alaska Democratic Party Chair Mike Wenstrup said in a statement he was, quote, disappointed that my friend and colleague may have exercised poor judgment while on personal leave and jeopardized the safety of herself and others, end quote. Wenstrup said Kavanaugh's performance as executive director, quote, to date has been exemplary. I remain confident in her ability to perform her responsibilities as she continues to move the Alaska Democratic Party forward. The charges against Kavanaugh are misdemeanors. Kavanaugh has been in the role for nearly 3 years. The commercial Dungeness crab fishery in southeast Alaska will close early this summer because the start of the season has been so slow. Coast Alaska's Angela Denning reports.
In recent years, Dungeness crabbing has been pretty great for commercial fishermen in southeast. The harvests and prices have been above average, sometimes way above. Last year saw the second highest harvest on record and the highest price ever paid. The summer season was worth $13 million. But this year looks different. The season opened on June 15th. About 200 fishermen registered in the region, and they've reported poor fishing.
I've heard generally it's slow. Region-wide.
Joe Stratman is with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and he's the lead biologist for shellfish in the region. He says the estimate for this summer season is just about 2 million pounds, which is less than what's needed for a full-length season. It doesn't come close to recent years.
The poundage landed in the first week of the fishery was about 433,000 pounds, which was half, actually not quite half, of what was landed in the first week, the last summer season, 2021.
Because of the slow start, it was announced on June 29th that the season would close 2 weeks early at the end of July. The state manages the fishery according to harvests and sampling in season only. There is no other data gathered throughout the year. Managers look at what the first week of the fishery was like and predict the overall season harvest estimate and decide how long the season should be. Prices for dungies have plummeted this year. Processors are paying around $2.79 a pound compared to last year's $4.21 a pound. Still, the current price is around the 10-year average. It's only the third time in the last 20 years that the season has been shortened. Stratman says the downturn could be part of a natural cycle.
You know, those kind of fluctuations in harvest are pretty common in Alaska and in other places. It's possible that this year the below average catch rates are due to smaller than usual cohort of crab recruiting into the fishery, but there could be environmental factors as well.
Those factors could be a couple of things. Fishermen started the season off with huge daily tides, moving 24 feet twice a day. Also, crabs molt or regrow their shells once a year as adults. Crabs with soft shells aren't kept. Stratman says water temperature was colder than normal, which could have affected that.
So that may be playing a part in the molt timing or maybe making crab less active. These are all possibilities.
The first week's catch also means that, as of now, the fall season will be cut in half for most of the region, lasting only 1 month. That could change if the State Department determines that a lot of soft-shelled crab contributed to the low numbers. Stratman says they'll make the decision on the fall season in mid-August. The fall fishery starts October 1st. Reporting in Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The IBEW is the union of skilled hands and generous hearts, hardworking people on the job and off. It's the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, the IBEW. This message sponsored by the IBEW Local 1547.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
This year's 4th of July parade in downtown Anchorage had an unauthorized political element.
What is freedom?
Freedom is choice!
What is freedom?
Freedom is choice!
An impromptu contingent of abortion rights advocates decided to march in the parade. Organizers say they lined up with the registered groups moving along the street, and no one tried to stop them. Other people joined on the fly. Protester April Rochford says speaking out is the only way Independence Day has any meaning for her now.
I was born into a country where I was guaranteed certain rights, and now they're gone. So I don't get the point of today at all, except to protest the out of it.
In late June, the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, removing federal protection for abortion rights. The decision is celebrated by many conservatives and others who believe abortion is morally wrong. The campaign of Republican U.S. Senate candidate Kelly Chewbacca was expected to march, but did not appear. According to right-wing blog Must Read Alaska, the veterans group that organizes the parade denied the group's entry. Rules for last year's parade are posted online, and they specify that political signs and materials are not allowed. Well, election season is upon us, and this year Alaska Public Media and our media partners are covering elections differently. We're moving beyond just looking at polls and listening to politicians. We want you to help direct our coverage. To do that, we're getting out into the community and listening. As part of that strategy, we have a new engagement editor, Ann Hillman. Alaska Public Media's Lori Townsend spoke with Hillman recently and asked her what she has found to be effective in reaching people we normally don't hear from or who don't listen to our news programs.
Honestly, it's just being out in the community. So, and I've done this with a number of projects. It's sitting in front of the library with a table and asking questions and being willing to listen. It's wandering on the beach during dip netting. It's going to events. It's putting things on the internet and trying to advertise for them in different ways. But I have to admit that I'm an advocate for meeting people literally where they're at.
And so drill down a little bit there and talk about how you'll gather this information and then what happens?
Basically, what we're trying to get at is what do people care about most? So what do they want the candidates really talking about? And then what are other types of information people want? And how do we get that to them? So, yeah, we produce a lot of amazing radio and television, and there's newspaper articles that are out there. But is that the most effective way to help somebody understand ranked choice voting or help somebody understand really what one candidate is saying versus what another candidate is saying? And so in some ways, yeah, we can do kind of your traditional things of having online surveys. We have one right now at alaskapublic.org/elections. But another really great way is actually just convening groups of folks together and having listening sessions where you bring people into the same room and sit down and you have journalists there who are just listening and community members who are getting a chance to talk to folks that maybe they don't know with prompts, with post-it notes. That's always useful ways to drive conversations and food and make it more of a community event. So it's people sharing with each other as well as with us and building community in a lot of different ways.
You have recently been out in the community at an event. How did that go?
A couple of my colleagues and I went and we hung out at a table at the Juneteenth celebration here in Anchorage. And it went really well because people really do want to talk to each other and talk about what they care about. And some people were like, you know what? We need to be talking more about how do we deal with issues around housing and around houselessness? How do we get services to people? How do we get politicians to actually talk policy and what they're going to do as opposed to just sharing words? How do we hold people accountable? How do we help people understand our governmental systems? So civics. So a politician might say, well, I'm going to accomplish X, Y, or Z. But the politician is part of a process and part of a larger group of people. So what do those words mean if they don't have a plan for actually collaborating with others?
And when you were at the Juneteenth events, were there some other issues that people said, I want politicians to address these things?
Folks definitely talked a lot about climate change. and climate change effects and mitigations. People did talk a lot about affordable housing. Folks talked about things like mental health supports. One woman was talking a lot about trans rights and how do we make sure everybody is treated equitably. That was kind of a very running theme.
It seems that there's more polarization now around some issues than maybe we've ever seen in the past. How will you work to bring those divergent views into the groups that you convene?
You know, everybody says there's so much polarization. And if you look at it from the way that it's often written about or the way that we communicate in short form social media, yeah, it looks like that. All of our stories are complicated. Our views are complicated. There's so much gray. But oftentimes we never talk about those grays. And so what I found in projects that I've done in the past around the state is that if you create a welcoming and safe space, and a safe space where people understand that, you know what, yeah, you might think something different than the person next to you, or actually you might have a lot of overlap and you just never had a chance to find out. It's a safe space where the goal isn't let's convince people to believe X, Y, or Z. Let's get people to change. Where the idea is, let's see where we overlap. Let's understand the nuances. Then real conversations happen. Real conversations around how do we as a community grow in healthy ways? And how do you get people with those divergent views into the same space?
Right. How do you get people who say, I have nothing in common with someone on that side of the political aisle?
Food. I mean, like, it sounds really simple, but to a degree, it's food. To a degree, it's saying we're going to listen whatever you think.
Without an agenda.
Without an agenda. And, like, we don't have an agenda. I have no agenda with this other than making sure that everybody is really actually represented and that our coverage is actually useful for everyone. It's putting up posters in grocery stores, you know, like the old school outreach, because certain places everyone goes. So you can reach a lot of diverse people in that one space.
So how can people get involved, Anne? How can they find out more?
The easiest way at the moment is to just go to our website, alaskapublic.org/elections. And there you can hit a little button where you take a survey, very short survey, and provide your email if you would like to, and then we'll get in touch. Very soon, we'll be hosting a series of community conversations. Some people call them focus groups. I like to think of it more of sitting down together to chat. You can participate in those by letting us know your email, or we'll be posting about those events through a lot of different media partners. And my email is also on our website.
All right. Thanks so much. That was Alaska Public Media's engagement editor, Anne Hillman.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Lex Trinan, Liz Ruskin, and Lori Townsend in Anchorage, and Angela Denning in Petersburg. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby. I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. One of the greatest honors for a public media station is delivering on its promise to provide quality programming and news you can trust to the communities it serves. What you hear on air is the result of a dedicated team working together to bring you the best. It's a privilege to be a part of your day. Thank you for listening, for your feedback, and for your support. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.